Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 201 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling the one and only Kim Garland Campbell, about my conversation with the world's sole club wheat breeder. Her official title is Research Geneticist with the Agricultural Research Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and she is based on the Washington State University campus in Pullman. Those unfamiliar with the roles of the ARS and WSU may conflate the two, but employees are paid and led by separate, although cooperative, organizations. USDA is federal, and WSU is state. Campbell's job today has a direct line reaching back to Orville Vogel's position on the WSU campus beginning in the 1930s. Vogel, too, was a USDA wheat breeder, renowned today for his introduction of the first semi-dwarf wheat variety, Gaines, in 1960. Campbell, who arrived at the WSU campus more than 20 years ago, may have had no experience in production agriculture growing up, but she finds herself right in the middle of it today. Her route to breeding wheat began in high school as she read gardening seed catalogs, which included features on plant breeders. For a young woman who wanted to make the world a better place, agriculture appeared to be a good place to start. But then that's something you might expect from a woman who served in the Peace Corps and also graduated from a theology school before setting her sights on a career in agriculture. I have interviewed Campbell plenty of times as a reporter, and more recently as communication director for the Grain Commission and host of this podcast. In fact, Campbell features in a couple of my favorite podcast episodes entitled Dead of Winter, Alive with Life, when she and her colleague, Karen Sanguinet, talked about what happens to wheat during the winter. It's episodes 104 and 105. You can find them on the Grain Commission website at wagrains.org. My point in telling you about interviewing Campbell in the past is that although I found out a lot of interesting information about club wheat, or wheat in general, I really didn't learn anything about her. This episode rectifies that ignorance a bit for me, and I hope for you too. We began our conversation with me asking her to describe her youth growing up outside of Chi-Town.
I grew up in Naperville, Illinois, which is now it's a kind of upscale suburb of Chicago. But back then, it was still kind of a farm town that was becoming a suburb. And my family was actually part of that suburbification of Naperville. But Naperville's actually older than Chicago. It's about 30 miles west of the city.
And what did your parents do?
My mom, well, she was a registered nurse. She didn't retire till she was 70. So she did emergency room nursing most of her career and then did public health at the end of it. And then my dad was a manufacturer's rep. He was in business for himself, and he sold steel tubing.
No agriculture involved in your early years?
No, actually, there isn't any in my family whatsoever. I've been doing a lot of genealogy work in my family going back for years and years and years. We're city people.
So just out of curiosity, you have any hobbies?
Yeah, I like to ski, downhill ski, until I like to cross-country ski too. I run, and I like to read. I play the piano, not so much lately, but.
All right. Well, wonderful. I wish I played the piano, took all those lessons, and nothing stuck. Kim, although some of the researchers I've interviewed took a direct path to their current positions, I found that most tread a circuitous route to their destination. How about you? What did you want to be when you were in high school?
Initially, I wanted to be a nurse like my mom. And I actually did some volunteer work at the hospital, but then I think it was about my sophomore year, my mom told me she didn't think I'd be a very good nurse because I don't have a very good bedside manner, and, which I think she was right, actually. So then I really liked science and gardening and plants, and I had a garden in our yard, and I would read the seed catalogs, and they would always feature their plant breeders in the seed catalogs. And I thought, oh, that sounds like a cool job, because they were featuring flower breeders, many of whom worked a lot in South America and stuff. And so anyway, I thought that plant breeding would be fun. And then since I didn't grow up really, I did grow up in an I started taking vocational ag in high school, but the advisors in my high school really didn't know how to advise me into a plant breeding career. So I kind of had to look it up on in the encyclopedia and the dictionary. We didn't have the internet then.
Right.
And I landed on agronomy. This was also the time when we were having there was a famine in Ethiopia and a famine in Bangladesh. And this is going back, kind of shows you how old I am, but the Beatles had come out with the concert. It wasn't the Beatles. I think it was George Harrison with the concert for the Bangladesh album. So it was a big thing then. And so I thought, well, if you're going to be a plant breeder, it'd be good to work with food. And so that's where I found agronomy. But I didn't actually know if I had picked it right until I got into my Agronomy 100 class on my first day as a freshman at Colorado State. And they did, okay, here's a definition of agronomy. And I thought, oh, good, I'm in the right place.
Okay. And then what happened after you graduated?
Well, then I joined the Peace Corps because that was the most logical thing to do with that major. And I got assigned to Antigua, West Indies, which is my Peace Corps friends laugh at me because it's a resort island in the Caribbean. But at the time, it was not as resorty as it is now. And they were trying to redevelop their agriculture in a way that would help to feed the people and provide some economic advantages.
You know that I was a Peace Corps volunteer as well, don't you?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. Where were you located?
Togo, West Africa.
Oh, see, that would be very different from the West Indies.
Yes, just a bit. They were both hot, though.
Right.
So you subsequently went back to school and got a theology degree at a Lutheran seminary. Were you thinking of becoming a minister? And what happened to those plans?
I know I never really wanted to be a minister. I had been really involved in the Lutheran Church my whole life, really. I've always been a member of the Lutheran Church and really involved in youth group. When I was actually in Antigua, it just became more of a desire for me to learn more about Lutheran theology. And so I enrolled initially in the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago. Then I moved over to Philadelphia to be closer to Tom. I really just wanted to study theology deeper. The Lutherans have a really good, deep theology that goes back to Luther, of course. And it proved to be a really good experience, both intellectually and personally. So.
And so tell me about your evolution from studying God and the nature of religious beliefs to studying agronomics and the nature of plants.
That's a really good way to phrase that question, actually. So while I was in the seminary, I realized that, you know, people talk about vocation a lot when they're in ministry, like, what are you called to do? And I realized it was confirmed that I really wasn't called to be a minister, but I did think that I had been called for a long time to be active in agriculture. And so I started looking for where I could go back to school to get a master's. So I ended up at North Carolina State, which I think was really positive because North Carolina as a state is kind of a very, I mean, religion is really important to a lot of people in North Carolina. And so it was really natural for me then to say, well, you know, I was studying the Word of God in the Bible, and then I moved on to studying, you know, God's creation by learning a lot about biology and genetics. And I've kind of held that the whole time, my whole life, really.
How fascinating. You're married and have four children. Where are your kids now?
My oldest, who's a little over 30, is in Moscow. She owned a mountain gear store downtown, and she just sold it this summer, actually during the pandemic. and she's now studying nursing, but she's still in Moscow. And my second daughter just moved to Cincinnati to learn how to weld. She's taking a 7-month crash course in welding. And she's also an artist. She's thoroughly enjoying herself. Then my third daughter is now in Sisters, Oregon. And she has a degree in marketing from the University of Idaho. And she is working for a firm that operates rental cabins and things like that. And she and her boyfriend are, they do a lot of backpacking, mountain climbing. They live out of a van, you know. And then my my son is currently at University of Idaho majoring. He's a first-year senior because he's in civil engineering, so he'll do 2 years. And he's also in Army ROTC.
Oh, wow. You know, I have three daughters. I never did get that son.
Yeah, the son was kind of a surprise for us.
Okay, so into our cropping portion of the interview. Is it a simplification to say that there are Mattson-based club wheats and Eltan-based club wheats?
I think that probably kind of fits. The club wheat, you know, Briel, which came out of the winter wheat program, does have, it's not Eltan in the pedigree, but it's a line that is a parent of Eltan that's in the pedigree. And it does behave more like those wheats that you can plant out in the real dry areas. Pritchett actually is a line that has Briel and Chucker, which is out of my program in the pedigree. So it's a little more, Pritchett's a little more like Otto in that we've tried to kind of combine the Mattson and Eltan good characteristics together. And then other wheats like Castella and Chucker, definitely Chucker. Chucker did have actually Mattson itself in the pedigree. And Castella's got a breeding line that has Mattson in it in the pedigree. So,
and Chucker was your first release, wasn't it?
Yeah, actually, Chucker and soft white wheat called Finch were on increase when I got here. Bob Allen had identified both of them as having a lot of potential, and they were on increase as breeder seed when I got here. And so they were the first two that I released. With Bob, of course.
Okay, here's a question. You know, we hear sometimes that clubs don't yield as much as soft whites. I have heard that club wheats don't tiller as much as soft whites. Is that true?
I don't think that's actually a categorical truth. I do know that the club gene, like Bob did some work back in the 1980s where he compared near isogenics, which are wheat lines that are pretty much identical except for one trait. And so he had created these near isogenics in various backgrounds, but the only thing they differed for was whether they were club or whether they were lax or common. And he did find that there was slightly less tillering in those lines, in those club lines compared to the lax lines. But then when you get out into the, you compare all the clubs, like Briel and Pritchett tiller a lot. So do Eltans, you know, so does Curiosity. Whereas a line like Cara really doesn't tiller as much. But I would say Castella is kind of a big, tall thing, and it tillers quite a bit. So, and some of, I actually select for tillering capacity. So I think I try and pull it along as much as I can.
Does the dwarfing gene cause a yield drag? Have you looked at releasing a variety without the dwarfing gene?
To answer the second question first, yeah, because you know we're always screening a lot for emergence, so I always pull along a few standard height lines in the breeding program. However, I have never put any of them into variety testing because they just don't yield as well. I think in some situations the dwarfing gene can cause a yield drag, but I don't think it does in general. And you know, this goes back to Vogel. I have Vogel's field books because I'm the USDA breeder. He was the USDA breeder. And you go back and you look at when he was first working with those genes, and the yield increases are like 25% He didn't need statistics to say, oh, this is a gene we want to keep around. So I think the negative impacts of the dwarfing gene are because it really does affect coleoptile emergence, you know. And so, if you, like I like to say, if you can't get the crop up out of the ground, you don't have to worry about yield. So we really have to work hard on screening for emergence when we have the dwarfing gene present. And Aaron Carter has done a great job of, well, basically what we both do now is we just sock it in as deep as we can in dry environments and then rate what comes up and then keep that. But we both think that having that dwarfing gene around is better than not having it. So,
well, and the reason I ask is because given weed resistance issues, I just wonder whether we should take another look at growing non-semi-dwarf varieties because of them helping to shade out weeds.
Mm. No, that's actually a really good strategy. I think definitely I like selecting on the tall side of the dwarfing gene. And so that I told you I select for tillers too. So selecting for more tillers and taller wheat within reason, because you want it to stand up to that. I think that will help. Another thing is selecting for a wheat that gets up out of the ground fast and fills out, you know, does canopy closure fast and stuff like that. I think that can be a really effective strategy in some of our weed issues. So,
okay, winter wheat breeder Aaron Carter has a 2-gene beyond resistant Clearfield Club variety close to being released. Will this be a game changer or just more of the same? And how were you involved in that effort?
Well, that's Washington 8317. And when Aaron started here, we both kind of agreed that if I generated any soft whites in my program that were useful, I would hand them off to him kind of in the late development stage. And he would do the same with clubs and hand them off to me. And so we've been doing that now ever since he started here. And actually, Pritchett was one of the first ones of those. He handed me a bunch of lines that were just ready to be put into plots, and I selected through, and we generated Pritchett together. And so the same thing has happened with these Beyond lines. He handed them off to me, but he kept doing the spray trials because he is set up to do it, and my program really isn't. So that one probably has a little more of Aaron's involvement in it, but I've been the one that's pushed it through on the kind of quality side and competitiveness with quality and stuff. So 8317 itself is a 2-gene beyond club that I think will be useful for growers who want to grow club and they also want the 2-gene beyond characteristics. The issue with it is that it's essentially Briel with the imazamox resistance. So Briel is fading because of the issues with falling number, and this line has those same issues. I see it as a useful tool, but I don't really think it's going to become as popular as some of these other lines, like you know, his new 2-gene common that he has. And however, we are this one would be like the first one we're going to release. We have others. Both he and I have been making crosses to 2-gene MEs and screening them and bringing them up through the program. And we have several coming right behind it. This is kind of a long answer, but both of us question the utility of this technology going forward much longer, because where it's been widely used down further south, like Walla Walla in Oregon and that, you know, it's really become almost unusable because we've selected for group 2 resistant weeds. I think going forward, we really have to be careful how we use these herbicide resistant lines. And actually, Aaron is also working with the coaxium trait. He has coaxium clubs and coaxium commons. And we're kind of also concerned about those, that trait too. It's useful right now. What's its life? A lot of it depends on how we manage it and how we use it. So,
Okay, so those of us involved in the wheat industry know you as the club wheat breeder, but your actual title is research geneticist. How much time do you spend on wheat breeding and how much on other research?
Well, really, all my research involves some type of breeding. In fact, I just wrote out this list of things to do, and I was kind of surprised at that. I think the pre-breeding aspect of my work is probably at least half of what I do. So I do the club wheat cultivar development, and then I do this other aspect called pre-breeding, which is basically creating germplasm for other geneticists to use or for other reasons. And we work a lot on stripe rust resistance. We do a lot of screening nationally for resistance to stripe rust and report that data back. That's throughout the country. And then we are also working on soil-borne diseases, Fusarium crown rot and cereal cyst nematodes. And then another thing that we've gotten into lately is working on nutrition in wheat, like trying to make the wheat grain more nutritious and increasing the mineral elements, like increasing iron and zinc in the grain. And then also I have a student right now working on improving the quality of whole grain flours. And so she's looking at clubs for that, but she's also looking at commons for that. We're doing a lot of crossing to kind of wild looking wheats, trying to bring some new traits for nutrition and agronomics into the pipeline. So
you're also involved with cold tolerance, aren't you? And I'm just curious, I mean, is the climate changing enough to make the cold tolerance of wheat less of an issue?
Yeah, that's a good question. Although I've been hearing that ever since I got here. So yeah, we've done a lot of work on cold tolerance, and we've identified major genes that are associated with it. And we do a lot of screening, you know, and rating lines and sending that data out to farmers and to other breeders. And, you know, I do know that the climate is warming. You know, in the years that I've been here, I've seen a difference in how wheat matures and responds. And I do think that heat tolerance is going to become a much more critical factor than it has been in the past. But on the other hand, almost every year we still get cold snaps. You know, like last spring, I had to go down to Assotin, well, up to Annatone, actually, and take a look at a lot of wheat that had been pretty severely damaged by cold. And it was not gratifying for the farmer, but it was gratifying for me to see that my ratings from the greenhouse matched what I was seeing in his field with specific varieties. So I think working on cold tolerance will continue to be important.
There's something called the Club Wheat Collaborative that you are working on with the Japanese milling industry and the Washington Grain Commission. Tell me about the effort and what is the goal?
So the goal is to facilitate communication between the Japanese end users and us here in the Pacific Northwest, because we're basically the product. And as you know, by far the Japanese are our major market. And they're also they're the group that sets the standards for the entire market, even the club wheat that goes to other countries. You know, they kind of look to the Japanese for the standards for that. So I really wish we had been able to do this earlier in my time here, but at least we've done it now, you know. And so it was started, I think it was in 2017, but it was really the efforts of the Washington Grain Commission going over to Japan and establishing those relationships and through U.S. Wheat to bring us all together and talk about what it is that we know, what we don't know, you know. And we realized that some of the testing that they do is slightly different from the testing that we do. And so we want to make sure we are aligned in the testing so that what I developed based on the testing at the Western Wheat Quality Lab matches with what they want. And then also where they can talk directly to me as the breeder. There are other people who do a little bit of work in clubs, but I'm basically the club wheat breeder. And like I like to say, I'm the only one in the world. So, you know, it makes the job a lot of fun, but it's really good for me to be able to talk directly to the main people who buy that wheat to make sure that we're aligning. And that's the goal. So we initially we went over and paid a visit to Japan, and I got to go through some of the mills and talk to some people, and then they came here, and then we were going to go back, but we couldn't this year because of COVID. So we did have a virtual meeting just a week ago where we spent a couple hours and went over the data and talked about what our goals are for the future and stuff. So, and one of the things to come out of that was I realized the importance of texture in the products. Then I think the other thing is that the other really great thing on that call last week was Mike Karstens was on there, and he was actually planting wheat when we were on the call. And so he could take his phone and kind of say, look, there's my drill. We're putting the wheat in the ground, you know? And so I think it's giving the Japanese Flour Millers Association a really nice appreciation for what the farmers are doing in the Pacific Northwest.
That was Mike Karstensen, a member of the Washington Grain Commission that Campbell referred to on the call with the Japanese from his tractor as he was seeding his winter wheat crop. For those new to the podcast, I was on the tractor interviewing Karstensen in episode 72 during spring seeding in May 2018. I returned to join him for harvest in episode 91 that September. If you haven't already, go to our website, wagrains.org, where you can listen to any of the 200 podcasts posted so far. One of the things I learned early in my career is that nobody is indispensable. And yet, in Campbell's case, I'm not sure that's entirely true. You heard her say she is the only club wheat breeder in the world. I think for a large group of farmers in the summer fallow wheat region of eastern Washington, indispensable is probably an accurate description of her invaluable role. In episode 202 of Wheat All About It, I continue my conversation with Campbell, asking her whether a succession plan has been created for the club wheat breeding position. Being unique has its advantages, but in a cost-cutting world, it can also leave a post vulnerable. Join me next week when I ask Campbell whether the club wheat program will continue when she finally decides to retire. Right here on Wheat All About It!
You think we're simple, you think we're not right. Look at your cities and ask yourself who's right. We've got country and you've got crime. We've got green and you've got grime. Let there be no doubt, we have what it takes to till the soil until our back aches. Just give us a break and don't be so rude. We love the work and you love the food.
We feed you.